Welcome back to Outstanding in the Field, a podcast by Perennia highlighting production practices, pest management, and more for field crops in Nova Scotia. I'm your host, Provincial Field Crops Specialist, Caitlin Condon. Weed control is one of the major management issues faced on the farm year after year, particularly with the potential for weeds to develop resistance to herbicides, as well as the rising cost of those products. Today's guest, Brianne Tideman from AAFC in Alberta, is going to introduce another tool that has the potential to be added to the integrated weed management toolbox in the form of harvest weed seed control. All right. Welcome to the podcast. Thanks so much for joining me today.
No problem at all.
So before we get into the meat of it here today, can you just give us a brief introduction of who you are and what you do?
For sure. So I am a research scientist with Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada based in Lacombe, Alberta, and I am a weed scientist. So I work on agriculture weeds like dandelion and wild oat and cleavers, not the other kind of weed that most people jump to immediately when I say weed science. Every weed scientist you meet will almost always follow it up with not that kind of weed scientist.
And yeah.
So I am not that kind of weed scientist. I grew up on a grain farm in central Saskatchewan, west central Saskatchewan, and did all my schooling at the University of Alberta, and then ended up in Lacombe. And I've been here, how long have I been here? Since 2016 as a scientist. Working on management of weeds in our agricultural crops.
Awesome. So can you tell me about what harvest weed seed control is and what got you interested in it?
Yeah, so harvest weed seed control is a paradigm essentially of weed control, or a strategy of weed control that was developed in Australia. And the whole idea behind it is that the weeds that are in the field that have survived the growing season and have matured at the time of harvest, we do them a great big favor when we take our combines through and we take those weed seeds in that are still on the plant, and then we broadcast seed them back across our field to be next year's problem. So we help them disperse, we help them spread out. They love us because the best broadcast seeder we have for weeds is our combine. And so the idea behind harvest weed seed control is exactly that, to manage the weed seeds or control them at the time of harvest. So do something instead of just broadcast seeding them. And there's lots of different methods, which I know we're going to talk about in a bit. How I got into it, I read a little bit about it when I was a master's student, actually, in weed science. One of the papers that we read in one of the weed science courses I took was on one of the methods of harvest weed seed control that was being developed in Australia. And I thought it was really cool. And then as I finished my master's, I had the opportunity to start a PhD project with my predecessor at the time, Dr. Neil Harker, and Dr. Hugh Becky, who was with Ag Canada in Saskatoon, that they were starting to move into this idea of, let's see how some of this could work here. So I got to jump in there as a PhD student, and to many farmers out here, I'm that seed destructor girl. So that's kind of an area that I've stuck to working in and have really been trying to be useful in that space over the last few years. So.
Yeah, awesome. No, I think it's such a cool concept. So I'm really looking forward to getting into it with you here today. So you mentioned that there's different methods of harvest weed seed control. So can you talk about the difference, well, what the various methods are and some of the differences between them?
For sure. So the first thing I'm going to say that I think is really cool is a lot of these methods were developed by producers. So you've got everything from sort of fairly low tech, like, you know, they did the welding and building at home to now some of the more high tech stuff. Mm-hmm. So one of the ones that really caught on at the start in Australia was something called narrow windrow burning. And so what the producers were doing was, instead of spreading their chaff and their straw, they developed essentially these V-shaped funnels that they would bolt onto their combine. They would drop the straw and the chaff into like a swath behind the combine, and then they would go along afterwards and burn all of these swaths. And they had all kinds of strategies for, you know, you want to have a crosswind and you would light it this many times over this far of a distance, and you want to have these types of weather conditions to get the hottest, longest burn to really drive down those weed seed viabilities. So that was one of the big ones. Chaff carts is another big one in Australia, which is kind of funny because the original chaff carts were essentially developed in Saskatchewan and in the prairies.
Okay.
And they didn't really catch on all that much. Huh. And the Australians started importing them and using them and upgrading them. And now they're bigger there and we're importing back this way a little bit to North America. So it's kind of funny that way. But the idea behind those is exactly what they sound like. They're a cart that you pull behind the combine. You collect all the chaff, And then the chaff is either dumped off of the field or in like specific areas of the field. And then those chaff dumps are either grazed by animals or they're burnt. Chaff lining is another one that's been developed. Again, you can get sort of the fancy version or the homemade version of them, and farmers use both quite effectively. And the idea is you concentrate the chaff into a line behind the combine, and you get, in theory, sort of a composting decomposition effect.
Okay.
And or there's just enough chaff there to limit some of the emergence.
Right.
And or you've at least concentrated the weeds into a single row and you can just manage that single row instead of having to manage your entire field.
Right.
They've also gone to, in Australia, there's a lot of controlled traffic farming producers. And so they've got chaff tram lining, which is where the chaff is put down onto the wheel tracks that they're continuously driving on.
Yeah.
So in addition to all of those other benefits of chaff lining, you're also just sort of doing some physical control by continually driving on those weeds.
Right.
So some benefits there. Let me think what other ones I'm missing, because I feel like I'm missing something. Oh, the Bale Direct system. Is another one that's been developed. It's not as common because it's a little bit of a smaller market, but the idea is that you take the chaff, and in particular, this is chaff focused, although some of them are straw as well. You bale it up and you take it off the field.
Mm-hmm.
And as that bale leaves the field, so do the weed seeds.
Right.
So you're exporting them off the field. Hopefully, you know, the manure of whatever animal those bales are being fed to doesn't come directly back into your field with viable weed seeds, because
right.
Some weed seeds are survives digestion a little more than others, but the idea is you're exporting them off the field to not be a problem. One of the bigger ones, and one of the ones that I would say a lot of the research globally has been focused on, is the use of a physical impact mill. The one that most people recognize the name of would be the Harrington Seed Destructor. That was sort of the original version of this.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big toe behind giant thing that had to be lugged behind the combine, which is what I get to work with because that's what we have. And there was a lot of pushback initially from producers on that because no one wanted to deal with that kind of equipment behind their combine.
Right.
Understandably, it's a pain in the butt. But that was just sort of the starting point, and it was always intended as the start point.
Mm-hmm.
And now what they've got is mill systems that mount into the back of your combine, sort of underneath the straw spreaders. And it collects the chaff. It essentially mills the chaff into a very fine powder, which also disintegrates or breaks down a lot of the weed seeds in there and breaks them into small enough pieces that they don't germinate. So that's been one that I've done a lot of work on. There's a lot of research being done globally on that particular one because it doesn't involve fire.
Mm.
You don't have to have animals to graze it. You're not exporting all of your organic material, your straw, your chaff, your residue. So you get all the nutrient benefits still of that material.
Right.
But you're still doing something to those weed seeds.
Yeah.
So that's kind of been one that's been a big focus for a lot of us in terms of sort of the sustainability of the practice. The only other one I'm going to mention, actually, I'm going to mention two more. Sorry, I lied. One is still sort of just in the initial research phases, as far as I can tell. It's being developed in the US where they're utilizing blue light and heat to treat the chaff.
Oh, cool.
As a way of impacting seed viability. And the other one is actually one that my colleague in PEI is working on for use in potatoes. So using a potato vine crusher that was initially developed for insects.
Mm-hmm.
To try and also crush some of the weed seeds. So he's kind of been working in that area trying to work in sort of his specialty crop and find some harvest weed seed control options there as well.
So are there differences in efficacy between the different methods?
If they were all utilized properly and, mm-hmm. and utilized with the good strategies and things like that, most of them were fairly effective.
Okay.
So like narrow windrow burning, you could get 90 some percent control of the
wow.
weeds if you had that long hot burn.
Yeah.
And like I said, there was strategies. You were waiting for a certain wind. You were waiting for moisture at this certain time.
Yeah.
Some of those kinds of things. Like they were getting pretty good at optimizing when and how to get that long hot burn. Something like chaff lining tends to be a little bit less efficacious.
Okay.
It's also one of the cheapest things that you can do. Like you could weld
right.
a chute for a couple $100 and go.
Yeah.
So there's also sort of a progression that they're seeing in Australia where people are starting with some of those lower technology, cheaper upfront cost technologies to prove to themselves that, you know, yes, I'm collecting these weed seeds. Yes, I'm concentrating them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're sort of upgrading to some of the more expensive options like a chaff cart or a mill sort of
right.
thing. So there is a little bit of range in efficacy that way. But for the most part, it's doing what it's supposed to do in not spreading those weeds and giving you other options for managing them.
Right.
And if you utilize the good strategies and are very intentional about how you're using those different methods, they're quite effective.
Awesome. Yeah, I can imagine there's some pros and cons to some of those. Like, with the windrow burning,
that's a lot of fire and a little bit risky.
You gotta try to control the fire.
Yeah.
which can be a little anxiety inducing.
Yeah, I fully agree. And so it was, talking to some of the producers using those, they would even sort of rank, some of their crops that they were more willing to burn than others.
Okay.
And they would have like a threshold of, this crop is yielding too well, there's too much residue, we're not burning this one.
Right.
Or some of those kinds of things. They all did mention to me that when they were lighting the rows, that yes, we carry fire extinguishers just in case kind of thing. And it was like, yes. Well, yeah, I'd hope so.
Yeah, really.
That one is one that I really have not pursued at all in Western Canada,
mm-hmm.
because we're so darn dry in the harvest, and trying to get back out in the spring when you're supposed to be seeding. I mean, farmers would laugh me out of room, rightfully so.
Yeah.
So it's not one we've really pursued very much in Canada, but they were doing it very effectively. The one farmer, I want to say he was doing like 10,000 acres or something like that, and very successfully managing it with narrow windrow burning.
Wow.
So
amazing.
Yeah, it was doable, it was feasible, but yeah, there's a few things that concern me about a few of those.
Yeah.
And the nutrient management is a big one for me with like the chaff dumps or mm-hmm. even the chaff lining, the bale direct. We want to keep those nutrients on the field, and we don't necessarily want to concentrate them. We want them still evenly spread and all those sorts of things. So there's definitely pros and cons, but different farms have really found different things that work for them. So if you are a mixed farm and you have a use for that feed, fantastic.
And especially if it's going to be a part of the system and there's going to be manure going back out eventually anyways. So then you are keeping those nutrients for sure.
Yeah. So it's definitely farm specific in terms of some of those pros and cons.
Yeah. So with the seed mills, does seed size matter? Is there like certain types of weeds that this works better for than others?
Yes and no. Okay. is the short answer. So this one is a little bit frustrating for me to explain. So that was one of the questions that I was really interested in my PhD was, what factors affect how well this works? Is it chaff volume? Is it chaff type? Is it seed number? Is it seed size? Is it, what impacts this? And so we looked at all of those. And while we would find statistical differences, so there mm-hmm. was statistically significant differences between, my kochia and my wild oat seed, say, but it was a difference of 97.3% to 97.6%. So yes, but no. I mean, yes, statistically, I have to say there was a difference, but does a farmer really care about 0.3%? Right. Probably not. It worked really good. Is the long and short of it. So anything that's going into the mills, from what we found, it's very effective at killing those weed seeds. Research from the U.S. has found an impact of chaff moisture. And that, it makes logical sense, because when things get tougher or damper or moister, they don't flow as well. So you get more buildups. Mm-hmm. And so you see a little bit less efficacy there. And if you really push it, then you see plugging, which is not a giant
Never
surprise,
good.
I don't think. Not good, but not really a surprise in my opinion.
No,
I mean,
no.
We know that. If we push tough material into a combine, eventually we're going to find that line where we just plug the combine.
Yeah, for sure.
Same thing with the mills. The bigger issue is actually getting the seeds into the combine.
Okay.
So we have a variation in terms of species that hold their seeds really well until maturity, mm-hmm. and seeds that start losing their seeds before crop maturity. So in Western Canada, wild oat for us is an issue. Mm-hmm. Wild oat sheds its seed early. We're looking at only about 30% of the seeds left on the plant at maturity. So you're just not getting the majority of those seeds.
Right.
The other ones that we see issues with is things like dandelion or sow thistle or Eastern Canada. Hang on, help me out. The ragweeds or the fleabanes, anything that floats.
Lamb's quarters, yeah.
Yeah, lamb's quarters is actually pretty decent, but anything that floats,
yes.
like a dandelion where you can blow and the seeds blow away, those are an issue because when the combine comes through, we knock a lot of those seeds off. They float away. They don't go into the combine. And so that's where we're seeing more issues by species. It's not so much if we put south thistle seeds into the mill, we hand put them in there, they will be crushed. They will die. But it's actually getting them into the combine.
Yeah, that's just not happening in the field. Yeah,
that's where we're seeing issues. So with wild oat, as my example in the West, we've got 97 point something or other percent control when we fed it into the mill. It did a really good job. I just can't get that many of them into the mill. There's things that you can do to help that, you know, using earlier maturing crops, swathing your crop, things like that. There's strategies there. And there would potentially be strategies where, you know, okay, so my wild oat, I'm really targeting for harvest wheat seed control with, say, a winter wheat because it's earlier maturing or those kinds of things. But like everything else, it's still putting a selection pressure on your wheat populations. And so you might see south thistle become a more dominant weed or something like that because that particular control measure isn't working on it. Just like where you use a herbicide that doesn't control a weed, that weed becomes more dominant, right? So
absolutely.
It's like every other weed control tactic where it's not a silver bullet and the weeds are going to respond.
So with the units that would be, you know, put directly onto the combine or towed behind, how would that affect combine performance?
So you do need a new enough combine to be able to handle the horsepower draw. And the question I always get with the mills is how many horsepower? And my answer at this point is I wish I knew. With the tow-behind unit, the big giant monster that I work with, it draws about 120 horsepower. It's a big draw. It's a big unit. I know we were under that when we started putting the mills into the combines. Started at like 80 horsepower. I had heard it had dropped to 60 some. And then there got to be more brands of the mills on the market, and this became a competitive advantage. And now those numbers are not really shared with me.
Right.
It's much lower than it was before. So how much lower? We're really improving it. To what? A whole lot lower. Okay, you're not going to give me a number. I understand. And fair enough. It is a competitive advantage. It's a competitive market. I get it. But so I don't know exactly how many horsepower those units draw anymore. I know it's come down. I know they're continuing to work on that.
Yeah.
What the Australians have said is you can expect to lose about a class of a combine. So if you're if you're operating a class 8 combine, it's going to run at about the efficiency of a class 7 now. With the mill on board. You do have to slow down potentially a little bit. You will see a little bit of increased fuel use. The farmer, one of the farmers that I talked to quite a bit that runs it in Saskatchewan, I want to say he said about $1 per acre of extra fuel use for running his mill system. So it wasn't
a lot cheaper unreasonable. Than some herbicides though.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, it there is a cost.
Yeah.
From what I've heard, it doesn't sound like it's an unreasonable cost for the benefit that you're getting. And what the Australians have told me, you know, it does lower that class of the combine, but if you can harvest the harvest the crop, it's based on the volume of the crop sort of thing. So if you can harvest the crop at 3.5 miles an hour, you can harvest the crop at 3.5 miles an hour with the mill on. It's, you know, if you have to slow down because it's a heavier crop, well, you'd probably need to slow down for the mill too type of thing. So it seems to be a very direct link there.
For sure. Very cool. What other challenges have you heard about adopting this technology? Like, obviously it's working great in Australia.
Cost. The original tow behind unit was about $200,000.
Wow.
The built-in mill units range around that $100,000 mark. That it bumps up and down a little bit. I mean, 3 of the 4 brands on the market are Australian, so exchange rate comes into play a little bit there. And the numbers were dropping. We were sort of hitting 100,000 and less. And then as with everything else, costs of production went up. And I think it's kind of come back to that in and around 100,000 mark for each of them. And then it depends a little bit on what type of combine you're operating.
Yeah.
How much they have to modify things to get it in there.
Right.
You can buy some new combines with mills incorporated. There's some of the brands that have agreements with various colors of combines that you can actually purchase a new combine with it incorporated and things like that. But cost has really been the big one and the big roadblock to guys trying it, I think. Also trying to explain that 30% of less seeds is still better than not getting any of
it. And especially when you're talking about like herbicide resistant weeds.
Yes.
You know, that you're not going to be able to get them with a lot of your other tools. So, you know.
And I think I also find one of the roadblocks is that it's just such a different timing or concept from what we're used to with weed management.
Yes.
So there's a lot of guys that are sort of like, why would I do this at harvest though? I've already lost all my yield for that year. And it's like, yes, this is for next year.
Right.
This is not going to help you at all for the year that you've just had. It's you're done. That's off the table. This is next year's problem that we're trying to minimize. And it's a very different shift in thinking that way because we're so used to looking at it within a season.
Yeah.
You know, this is what I do within my season to control my weeds. And this is something that you do within a season for the next season.
Yeah.
And
so it's a very different shift.
Yeah.
Longer term goal, longer term payoff, I guess.
Yeah. So it's a bit of a shift that way in terms of the idea behind it. So I've had that pushback conversation a lot of, well, that's stupid. Why would I leave them that long? And I'm like, no, you're still going to do your in-crop herbicides. You're still going to do your good IWM strategies, your seeding rates and your competitive crop advantage. You're doing all of that. This is to capture the ones that have escaped all of that.
Right.
And those are the ones that are probably going to be resistant or adapting to your other strategies already.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's a bit of a shift because it's not, some people think I'm coming in and saying, use this so you don't have to spray.
Mm.
I'm going, no, I
use this in addition.
Yes, this is an addition. And hopefully over time, you drive those numbers down enough that maybe you don't need a wild oat herbicide every year. Maybe you can just do a patch application of a wild oat herbicide or a kochia herbicide or a whatever herbicide over time. But when you first adopt, no, you're still going to be doing all those other things. This is in addition. And and to think of as sort of a cleanup or a prevention of spread of those resistant ones.
Right. So has there been any work done on the cost effectiveness of this type of practice in comparison to, say, just a traditional herbicide program or application? So we were just saying how you're going to use this in addition, so not at the exclusion of the other, but like kind of one application to doing this once.
There are cost calculators and cost benefit calculators and stuff, mostly in Australia, because they've actually got enough on-farm information to start really building those models. In Canada, we haven't done that yet.
Mm-hmm.
And partly because there's not enough producers really that I'm openly in contact with that will fully share with me, here's what I paid, here's what my interest rate was, here's how much fuel. Like, not a lot of guys really want to share that kind of personal information. That's their money business, right?
That's hard.
So, and I get that. But so we don't have the same kind of access to that information yet. But it's also going to be farm dependent, which is interesting to explain to people as well. So if you don't do this, what strategies are you going to use? Are you utilizing more expensive herbicides?
Yep.
What's that costing you per acre? How many more of those herbicides? What is your yield loss? What are you, you know, trying to parameterize that is really challenging. The farmer that I do interact with quite closely in Saskatchewan, so he runs 4 mills now on his farm.
Okay.
Two for sure. Might be four. And he's been running them since 2018, if I have that correct. So he's got quite a few harvests behind him now. And he does track. He tracked his initial upfront cost, the interest rate, the fuel use, the maintenance costs that he's had every single year over the acres that he's running these mills on. And so he's actually broken it down on his farm. I think he's looking at about $6.50 to $7 an acre.
Okay.
To run one mill.
Yeah.
And so his question then to a lot of other producers is, if I could offer you another herbicide for $6.50 an acre, would you take it?
Yeah.
It's thinking about this strategy as another mode of action, as a 5-gallon drum of herbicide that just happens to be attached to your combine instead kind of thing. So it's re-perspectiving that a little bit, I think. And he's been great for, like I said, keeping track of all those costs so that we have an actual on-farm use. Here's what it's costing, instead of me trying to put a model together and guessing at what all of these things might cost in a year.
Yeah, no, those actual costs are so valuable.
Yeah, and he can actually say, you know, I made it 5 years before I had to replace these parts. Replacing these parts cost me this much money. I use this much extra fuel. Like, so he's really got all of that. And
amazing.
So he's kind of my go-to on costs right now.
Yeah,
because
definitely.
They're real. they're real costs instead of me guessing at a cost.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. No, the modeled costs are never going to never going to necessarily take everything into consideration. And yeah, it's that real life application. So it sounds like the uptake on this in Australia has been pretty good.
Particularly in Western Australia, okay. Where ryegrass has been right. their dominant weed. So Ray Harrington, who is the farmer that really invented the Harrington seed destructor and really started pushing this mill type idea. When I talked to him about sort of, you know, why did you go so far outside the box?
Yeah.
And he said, I could either go outside the box and come up with something new, or I could get out of the game. So that's really where they were with ryegrass in a lot of areas in Western yeah. Australia was, we don't have herbicide options. So
right. What
else are we going to do? So Western Australia, I want to say they've got over 80% adoption, wow. Something like that. When you move into New South Wales or some of the other areas of Australia, that does drop a little bit because they yeah. are dealing with different weed species.
Right.
In the U.S., most of the U.S., it's still fairly low adoption. It sounds like there's a pretty good pocket in Washington State that are adopting either mills, bale direct systems. There's some doing chaff lining as well. So it sounds like there's a pretty good pocket of producers there that are starting to adopt. And then on the prairies, we're running, I know we've got about 20 to 25 mills running in the prairies, mostly central Saskatchewan and into the sort of east central Alberta along the border, a little bit in between, very much in Kochia country. A lot of guys that are dealing with Kochia are starting to look at this type of technology.
Yeah, well, we're lucky that we're not dealing with Kochia yet,
yeah.
but someday,
and
I'm sure.
I have heard there have been some sales of mills in Ontario. I have not been able to actually track down who purchased the mills and talk to them about it or anything like that, but I've heard there have been some mills sold out in Ontario as well.
So it's spreading.
Yeah. Slowly, but considering when I started working on this in 2014, the response to anything Harvest Weed Seed Control was what? So to actually hear that, you know, there's this slow early adoption happening is really exciting.
For sure. No, that's
and more really people exciting. Actually asking me with the serious intention of how would I implement this instead of just what are you talking about, woman? There's an actual like how could I use this on my farm? How would I look at implementing it type of thing? What would a strategy be for implementing it?
Well, and we're dealing with, you know, smaller fields and quite variable terrain in a lot of cases. So how would you see this type of practice maybe fitting into some of our conditions?
You know, I'd be really curious to see if there couldn't be someone take this on a sort of a custom type of project where you know, you leave your weed patches or you have a custom guy come in and open your field.
Yeah.
And do those outside rounds for you.
Yep.
I don't necessarily see it as that much different than having a custom sprayer.
For sure.
Or, you know, we're seeing that kind of system come in with electrical weeders in organic beans and things like that, where you pay someone to come in with their electrical weeder and you pay $1 per acre. So I'd be very curious to see if something like that couldn't be implemented. Mm-hmm. In Europe, I have family in Europe where they're sort of almost working in like a co-op system for purchase of equipment like this that is too expensive and not realistic for use on just one farm on its own.
Yeah.
But there's sort of a group of them in an area looking at purchasing a unit and sharing it around and utilizing it that way. So I don't think it's unreasonable to think some of those strategies might work.
Yeah, no, for sure. And we actually have some examples of that type of equipment sharing in Nova Scotia, in particular up in Cape Breton, one of the Federations of Agriculture has an equipment co-op, and it's because they're in a small area and they're fairly small farms, and it's given them access to so much more equipment and technology than any one farm would be able to look at on their own. So something like that has definitely worked in other situations. So this could be applied.
From the weeds perspective, weeds are not a field by field problem.
Right.
Not really.
Absolutely.
They spread, they move, we distribute them. So I don't think it's unrealistic to think that we couldn't take sort of more of a community management approach, especially when we are in communities that are smaller farms, equipment limited, that kind of thing. To say, you know, we've got a big issue with this particular weed. This is a technology that could really help us manage it and manage its spread.
Mm.
Let's look at this.
Very cool. I'm really interested to see kind of how this develops over the next several years and however long. I think it sounds like there's a lot of potential, and it sounds like it would be a really good tool to be able to add to people's integrated weed management plans.
Well, and I think if nothing else, you know, if even if the mills aren't reasonable, if these exact strategies aren't reasonable, that's fine.
Yeah.
But the whole concept of what are you doing to those seeds at harvest?
Mm-hmm.
And how are you going to manage their spread is such an important shift in our thinking about our weed management. You know, we do our good IWM, we make sure we've got competitive crops and good seeding rates, and we do our pre and our post herbicides and everything else. And then we kind of stop.
Right.
And this is adding that next step of, okay, what survived and how are you managing that? And it might come down to, are you cutting seed heads off?
Mm.
Are you going in with something else and cutting a seed head off so it doesn't produce seed?
Right.
Are you leaving a big patch and coming back and dealing with that afterwards, baling that off or doing something that's not spreading it? But, you know, thinking differently about, and I guess an awareness of those seeds that are left in the field.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they still there? Are they resistant?
Right.
Are they a late flush? What's happening that I'm still getting seed production in this field? And how do I not make the problem worse?
Yeah.
What can I do? And like I said, a lot of these strategies came from farmers. So just because I'm saying these are the strategies out there, that doesn't mean you have to use these ones.
No.
I've got a producer in Alberta that went, you know, I mow my patch instead. And I'm like, well, you're doing harvest weed seed control.
Great. Yeah.
You're just doing a different strategy. That's great. I love it.
For
like,
sure.
You don't have to do these ones. It's just more the concept and the idea of your combine is spreading what's left.
Yeah.
How do you stop that?
Yeah, just being able to zero in on that different timing that, as you said, we wouldn't usually necessarily consider that timing for dealing with seeds. So
And realizing that, you know, what goes into your seed bank in 1 year, it might only be 1 year seed bank input.
Yeah.
But is it a dormant weed? How long does that weed last in the seed bank? Is it
what's the long-term impact?
2 year weed seed bank? Is it a 25-year seed bank? So yes, it might only be 1,000 seeds, but if they're there for 25 years, over years, that can really have an impact on the populations you're dealing with.
Absolutely. Oh, very cool. I'm so fascinated by all of this, and I really appreciate you taking the time today to dive into it with me. And
I'm happy to. As you can tell, this is one of the things I love to talk about because I've spent a lot of time thinking about it, and it's one of those things that I think has the potential to have an impact on so many farms by just adding that perspective in and utilizing what works for you and tossing out what doesn't.
Yeah.
If you can't spend $100,000 on a mill, fine, so be it. I get
Absolutely.
It. But what else could we do?
Right.
And still targeting that time frame.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's the ability to make it really practical for whatever situation you're in.
And that's where I'm excited. So Andrew McKenzie Gopsel, who's dealing more in potatoes, went, how could I do something like this in potatoes? And then started working with the vine crusher. And I'm like, that is the coolest thing ever to me to take this concept and go, how does it work with what I work in or what I'm dealing with?
Yeah.
And that's where it's been a lot of fun to see some of that expansion in Canada with different crops.
Yeah.
No, I don't deal with that problem. I don't deal with ryegrass. I don't deal with this. How do I make it work for me?
Yeah.
And that's been fun to be a part of.
Yeah.
Even on the periphery. So.
No, that's great. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Yeah. No, I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Outstanding in the Field. Stay tuned for a written summary coming up in the next edition of the CropLinks newsletter, which you can subscribe to by visiting our website. Check out the show notes for links related to today's topic, as well as Brianne's contact information. You can subscribe to the podcast to stay up to date on future episodes. Follow us on social media at NS Perennia. Thanks to Perennia for supporting this podcast, and Rachel Oxner and the marketing and communications team for production and design.